John chapter 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to bear witness about the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness about the light. The true light, which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the Word was made through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor the will of the flesh, nor the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. The 4 weeks leading up to today, it's called Advent by the Church, and we took that time to do what we call the Christmas Primer. Primer is a kind of introductory text or course to something that you might not be familiar with, to kind of give you the basics. And the reason we did that was we just thought, you know, so much of Christmas, its original intent, its message had been kind of cluttered up with a lot of other things. Not necessarily bad things, but gift-giving and parties and musicals and whatever. All kinds of things. And yet, there was a story underneath all of this, and that's the story about Christmas. And so we did this to try to just reintroduce ourselves and anybody who might be listening to what the story of Christmas really is about. And we look first at how the Bible portrays it, and then we learn about some of the characters involved and really how it seemed designed by God to really undercut human pride and human power. An obscure family, an obscure village, a young lady giving birth to the savior of the world. I mean, just so many things about it seem designed to sort of exalt God through weakness, through humility. And then we considered the responses that various characters had to the arrival, the news that this child had arrived. And most were positive, biblically speaking. That is, the ones that are accounted. But there were a few troubled, even as we just read, that Herod himself, the king over that part of the world, was troubled by the idea that another ruler had come. And last week we looked at what we called the mystery and the mercy of Christmas, having to do with how it is that God becomes man, and God becomes a human being and dwells in like us and is us. And yet the reason why he did that was in order to be, as his name implies, Jesus, which means Yahweh saves, in order to save us from our sins. So we went through this Christmas primer, and it wasn't done to kind of, you know, push back against all the secularism and materialism of the world surrounding Christmas. We're not trying to rescue our religion from obscurity or preserve its place in the culture. And we did this really with a desire, frankly, that the same desire that John, who wrote this last bit of language that we wrote here from his account of Jesus' life, was called his gospel. That desire was that people would know about this Jesus and would come to believe in him. And that's really why we went through our Christmas primer, for the need, we believe, that people need to know who this Jesus is and to believe in him. Well, as I said, this reading that we just had was from John's account of Jesus' life, what's called Gospel of John. And it's the opening part of that. And it's often called John's Christmas story, because he doesn't have a birth narrative. He doesn't have the story about Mary conceiving, or the wise men coming, or the angels appearing to shepherds. What he does have, however, is this assertion that Jesus had an existence prior to his being conceived in the womb of Mary. Now, don't confuse that statement with what's taught in some religions, for Hinduism, for example, which believes that the soul takes up residence in another body, is reincarnated after the body dies. Now, John's not asserting Jesus' pre-existence before his conception in the womb of Mary in that way. It's not a reincarnation of Jesus, but the one and only incarnation of God, who takes the name of Jesus. Listen again to that opening language. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Now this language from John is a very strong echo of the language from the opening of the Bible, which you might be familiar with, beginning of Genesis, when it says, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth." So what John is asserting is that this one who he calls the Word is involved in creation. Right? All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. And on top of it, that he is the source of life and light. In him was life, and the life was the light of man. And then, a few lines later, as we read, at the very end of this prologue, this opening part, it says, "The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we've seen his glory, glory of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth." So this is what's being asserted by John's account of Jesus' life, that he was God in the flesh. He entered into our existence with a very specific purpose, to make people children of God. And that part of the prologue that we read is that all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of the blood, not of blood, nor the will of the flesh, nor the will of man, but of God. Now, a few minutes ago, right, I said that we undertook our Christmas primer with that same intent, the same intent that John had when he structured his account, so that people would believe that Jesus was the sent one from God, the Messiah, the promised one. Now, how did John go about doing this? Well, what he did is he included particular phenomena which he calls signs in Jesus' life that he believed would be persuasive. At the very end of this account of Jesus' life, the end of his gospel, he says this: "Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name." Now, his use of the word sign is very intentional, right? Excuse me, "Jesus did many other signs." By the term, he means what we mean when we say something is a sign, when we say something like sign of things to come or sign of the times. It points us to a way of understanding. So John has included these particular seven signs, though, as he said, he did many others, but he chose seven to include, to highlight in his account of Jesus' life, in order that understanding them, coming to see them, we might believe, we might understand that Jesus is indeed the Messiah, the Son of God. He included these seven signs. What are they, briefly? Well, the first one that we learn of is he shows up at a wedding, and he turns water into wine. He turns water into wine. He's at a wedding and turns water into wine in order that the festivities might continue. The second, he heals an official from Capernaum, the small town, Capernaum. He heals his son who is dying. And he doesn't, he does it from wherever he is. He's not in Capernaum. He's not at the bedside of the child. He just says, "Go, your son will live." And it comes to pass. The next sign that John includes is a healing of a man by the Bethesda pool. This is a man who had been an invalid for 38 years, was brought every day to the pool. They believed there was healing powers within the pool. And Jesus comes up to him and says, "Do you want to be healed?" He says, "Oh, I don't have anybody to get me in the pool when the waters are stirred." And Jesus says to him, "Pick up your bed and walk." And indeed, at once it says the man was healed. He took up his bed and he walked. The next sign is the feeding of the 5,000. Right, these large crowds now are following Jesus around. And at one point, it's getting towards the end of the day, and Jesus turns to his disciples and said, "What are you going to give them to eat?" One of them says, "It would take like 2/3 of a year's wages to feed all these people, and we don't have anything. All we've got is this boy's lunch with five loaves and a couple of fish, and that's all we've got." So Jesus says, "Well, sit down, and we'll break it up, and we'll feed them." That's what he does. He takes these 5 barley loaves, 2 fish, he breaks it up, and he feeds probably more than 5,000 people, because it could include all the children and everybody in that number. The next sign is him walking on water. At one point, his disciples leave him, and they're going across the Sea of Galilee. And as they're going across, suddenly they see this figure coming at them, and they're frightened, right? They think, what is this apparition? This is very strange. It turns out to be Jesus. It is I, do not be afraid. He's walking on water. The next sign that John includes is a man who was born blind. And this is probably the longest account that he has, and it's very significant. It's right in the middle of his gospel, because it's a man who's born blind, who's given sight by Jesus, and he becomes a metaphor for the spiritual blindness of the religious leaders of his day. And there's a great encounter, right, when he's brought to these religious leaders, and they say, you know, who did this to you? And he says, well, this guy told me to go put stuff on my eyes, and I went and washed him, and suddenly I could see. Well, who is this man? We know that he's a sinner. He says, well, that's interesting. He's a sinner, but yet he can heal my eyes. Well, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So anyway, they call him a sinner and they throw him out. But Jesus heals this man born blind. The next sign that he includes is raising of his friend Lazarus from the dead. Jesus is away some few days' journey from where Lazarus is. Word comes to him that his friend has died, and he goes to see him. And when he gets there, he assures that his sisters who've come to him weeping, says, don't worry, he will live. And so Jesus looks upon, he says, take away the stone. And Martha knows the situation. She says, Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he's been dead for 4 days. And Jesus said, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they took away the stone. Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me. And when he said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. And the man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips, his face wrapped with cloth. And Jesus said, unbind him and let him go. Those are the seven signs. And one could maybe include an eighth sign, which is Jesus' resurrection, his coming back to life himself. But even more, the resurrection, of course, would be a sign, but his confirmation of it when someone named Thomas doubted that he had really come back to life. His friends told him, we saw Jesus, he's come back to life. He says, unless I see it, and unless I put my hands in his side, I won't believe it. Thomas is just like us. Well, 8 days later, as disciples were inside again, Thomas was with them. Although the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. Then he said to Thomas, put your finger here, see my hands, put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe. Thomas answered, my Lord and my God. And Jesus said to him, have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. So these are the signs that John includes in order to persuade people that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah. Water turning into wine, healing of a dying boy by just speaking a word, healing of an invalid of 38 years, feeding 5,000 plus people from a boy's lunch, walking on water, raising Lazarus from the dead, and indeed standing alive from the dead. Now, all of these incidents are perfectly plausible if indeed he is God in the flesh. If he is the Word made flesh, if he is the one who brought everything into being, that it is perfectly plausible if he shows up on earth, takes on our existence, and does these kinds of things that no other human being could do. Because he's like no other human being, right? He is the Word made flesh. He is God incarnate. Water into wine. I mean, he's the author of everything. The material exists. He can reconstruct it at will. Healing of a dying boy by just speaking the word. Remember the opening of God, of Genesis? Let there be light. He speaks and everything comes into existence. Healing of an invalid for 38 years. I mean, he is from eternity. And whether a man has been lame for a day or for 38 years, he can speak and overcome the effects of corruption that sin has made in the world. Feeding 5,000 people from a boy's lunch. Jesus declares just after that, I'm the bread of life. Walking on water, he made it. Raising Lazarus from the dead, he's the author of life. Standing alive from the dead, the grave could not hold him. And here, perhaps, is the most significant aspect of Jesus' ministry. The grave could not hold him. See, he was God incarnate. He took on our existence on our behalf. See, biblically, the grave is an indicator of human failings before God. It is the product of what the Bible calls sin. And the divinely decreed punishment for sin is death. But here is Jesus, alive from the dead, because he did not deserve the grave. See, what we learn about this God in the flesh, what we learn about this Word made flesh, is that he lived a perfect life, a life of perfect obedience to the will of God. So he does not deserve, therefore, the punishment for sin. He doesn't deserve the grave. So when he dies, why does he die? He dies in our place. He dies on our account. He bears the punishment, our punishment, for our sin, not punishment for his sin. But yet, because he doesn't deserve it, he comes back from the grave, comes back from the dead, never to die again. So John's account, his intent in telling the story that he does of Jesus, the including of the signs that he does, is to show that indeed this one is truly the Word made flesh. And he says, these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. Again, I suggest that if indeed he is God incarnate, then these actions, as extraordinary, as unparalleled, as ridiculous as they sound, are perfectly plausible. Because he is God. He is God among us, not a human being who possesses divine attributes, not a human being who ascends to some sort of elevated level, but God who has condescended, who has descended to our level in order that we might be raised to his. This is Christmas. This is what is going on with that baby in Bethlehem. God has entered into the fullness of our existence from conception to gestation to birth to maturation to death. He takes on our whole existence in order that he might save us from our existence. We will be able, if we indeed place our faith in this one, believe that he is the Christ, the Son of God, we will be able to stand before God knowing that Jesus has done what we could not do. He lived our life for us. He died our death for us so that we might have life in him. This is the remarkable story of Christmas. This is the underpinning of all that the church has celebrated. And yes, it's been layered over with all kinds of things, and things that, again, are not inherently bad. But if we just sweep them aside a little bit, and look a little bit deeper into the scriptures, what we discover is the reason why the angels are singing, why the shepherds are astounded, why Simeon says he can die in peace, because God has fulfilled his promise. He would send a Redeemer, one who would pay our ransom, rescue us from sin and death. We celebrate that each year on Christmas. Pray with me.